from the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations and comments featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Soundings now presents the second of two discussions about politics in the modern American South. To what extent is politics in the South a peculiar expression of American society? How has the shape of Southern politics evolved over the last half century? The panelists in the following portion of the discussion are William Havard, Dewey Grantham, John Hope Franklin, and Edwin Yoder. Dewey Grantham and William Havard teach at Vanderbilt University, where they specialize in American political history. John Hope Franklin is James B. Duke Professor of History at Duke University. Edwin Yoder is a syndicated columnist for the Washington Post Writers Group. He has served as editorial page editor for the Washington Star. Both Dewey Grantham and John Hope Franklin have completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center, where Professor Grantham worked on a book about 20th century Southern politics, and Professor Franklin wrote a biography of George Washington Williams, the 19th century black political leader. Here is William Havard.
Well, may I begin with a couple of abstractions that relate to the entertainment value of Southern politics. After all, the South didn't have much money, white or black, and what little was there was all in the hands of the well-to-do whites. So politics was about the only form of public entertainment most people had, other than going to church. And sometimes those two-hour sermons got a little old. And they all turned out, though, at political meetings. And one of the contrasts was how little the issues were discussed, because those were all covered. In fact, that's best illustrated by a little story about a politician at the height of the controversy over evolution. And from the audience came this question by a rather stern-looking man. "Well, Senator, how are you on this evolution?" "John, I'm all right on that one. Next question, please." I think it's the oral tradition of the South. I think it's the idea that the South, in many ways, even apart from the demagoguery and so forth, has a strong oratorical tradition, which the demagogues corrupted in many respects. And after all, if you go back again to the Jeffersonian era, you get in the debates over the Constitution of Virginia, when they were trying to settle the slavery question not long after Jefferson's death, you get some of the finest principled oratory in the history of the Union. It's not been as well pointed to, except in Virginia, of course, as it has elsewhere.
I wonder if I might raise a question that Bill perhaps could comment on. I find it difficult to deal with the concept of the Southern demagogue or demagoguery. I think a broader term that may have relevance and usefulness might be something like man of the people, which suggests that there are effective popular leaders who are not demagogic. That distinction seems to me to be illusory and hard to nail down. Bill, could you define demagogue and demagoguery?
Well, I think that the easiest way to define it is simply to say that the person who is a true demagogue appeals in his rhetoric almost entirely to the emotional side of things. It doesn't make the appeal to the rational side, which I think is the only proper way to handle a rhetoric of principle. Now, Harry Williams is an interesting case because he refused to use the term demagogue in relation to Huey Long. He called him a mass leader. But there's no question in my mind that with the deterioration of Huey Long as a person, he did become almost entirely demagogic. But you can have demagogues of the right or the left, And you can have a demagogue such as Huey Long. Earl, I think, was not at all a demagogue. Earl was one of the funniest men alive, and one of the great things about him was that he still possessed a rural rhetoric.
I wanted to comment on Bill Havard's description of Earl Long, that it may be significant that in 1956, in the era when the packaging of candidates, the impact of television and the media were beginning to be felt, that Long, when offered by his aides an opportunity to use television, refused, saying that it'd make him look like a monkey on a stick, as he put it. But I think that that he really understood the sources of his strength as a campaigner, which was to get out to the branch heads and the creek beds and the rural areas, and to deal with people in a more traditional, homey way.
Let me say one more thing about demagoguery, and that is they also have to have a collective enemy. And the black served that purpose for so long.
I think there was still another quality of the demagogue, and that is he was rather earthy. I think almost everything that everyone has said has suggested that, and yet one doesn't want to confuse the Southern demagogue with the elegant Southern politician. That is, the Southern politician always been known for his eloquence, his style, and that sort of thing, even for his erudition. But the demagogue would not be in that category. He would be much more earthy. He would be, indeed, he would appeal to the people, even if it were through his assumed or alleged ignorance or his lack of polish, his lack of education and so forth. Bilbo was very good at that. Bilbo was a very well educated man, very well read, and a man, interestingly enough, with a rather modulated voice. I heard him many times in the United States Senate. Sometimes he didn't raise his voice at all. It was what he had to say and the way he said it, which I think would qualify him. And his knowledge of his subject was very frequently extensive, although he could sometimes either distort the material or use it in such a way as to show that he'd put his particularly emotional angle on it. He did this almost invariably in discussing questions of race and so forth. But my point is further that we are so completely dominated by the past and by what we think the past was, that we have to associate every dramatic event with the past.
You know, really, when you think about these chronological things, what we would have called in 1948, what we would have called normal Southern politics, in the VOK sense of the one-party system, malapportionment,
Jim Crow.
Jim Crow, and all the other things, really lasted only about 50 years. It wasn't consolidated till after the turn of the century, really. But it was, and the race issue as such, during that period, was played down except on those convenient occasions because it was so widely accepted.
Certainly there were possibilities in that post-Reconstruction period, many of which we've identified, pointing toward in the direction that Ed Yoder identified as a more pluralistic system. And the trends in the period since mid-century seem to be in that direction, opening up the system, making the system more democratic, more inclusive, But I would like to suggest a note of caution in not collapsing the chronology since 1948. The whole period has not been one of openness and accelerating change. The change in the South in the 1940s and after was enormous, economic and social change in particular. But I'm impressed with the slowness of the political response to that change.
Dewey, it seems to me a perfect illustration of your very valuable point there is what occurred in the South generally and in more particularly in the state of North Carolina in the 1950-51 period when you had the first, critical Supreme Court decisions bearing on admissions policies and that sort of thing. Sweat against Painter, I think, was 1951. And if I recall correctly, there was a critical decision that preceded that. Of course, they did not overturn the separate but equal doctrine, but they found inequality and as a result ordered open admissions. But then you had
Gaines' decision.
The Haynes
in Maryland. Gaines' decision.
Gaines, that's the one. But it illustrated the ambiguity of the situation, because the Gaines decision, and I'm glad, John, you prompted me on the name of it, had a critical effect on the senatorial primary in North Carolina, in which Frank Graham, who was then the incumbent senator, former president of the University of North Carolina, and in terms of his time and today, even those of today are a liberal on the race question, was defeated in what can only be called a blatantly racist campaign, and the climate in North Carolina ensuing from the Graham-Smith election in 1950 really cast a shadow over North Carolina politics. And we were speaking earlier about the difficulties of being explicit in among the more moderate and liberal white politicians seeking black votes, being explicit about their aims, and certainly the effect of that campaign in 1950 was marked for years in North Carolina politics, and it does illustrate what Dewey said about the sort of zigging and zagging and back and forth and the ambiguity of this development even after 48.
It was almost, it seems to me, in the 1950s, especially after Brown and after the Little Rock controversy, that Southern leaders mounting this fierce opposition, political resistance to school desegregation and really opening up the political system, that they thought it might be possible to reenact the crisis and the resolution of the crisis of the 1890s, that they might be able to contain the insurgency and the change that was being pushed upon them. As we know in retrospect, that was a miscalculation of enormous significance. While we should not be too hard on our persona here, the Southern political leaders we're talking about in 1948 and in the late 1950s and so on, they were indeed poor students of history. Mm-hmm. Mainly, I think, because the situations were so different with respect, one, to the position of the South in the Democratic Party, and two, the national situation that existed in the 1890s when the national government largely said to the Southerners, settle your own problems, deal with race relations as you like, and the situation in the late 40s and afterward, where it was no longer possible, and the whole constituency of the Democratic Party was different, the Southerners' place in the party was different, and the pressure from the national level to deal with Southern problems was very, very different from that of the 1890s.
All those contradictions and juxtapositions are what fascinate people by Southern politics, I think.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to the second of two discussions about politics in the modern American South. The panelists are Dewey Grantham, John Hope Franklin, Edwin Yoder, and William Havard. Dewey Grantham and William Havard are professors at Vanderbilt University. Edwin Yoder is a syndicated columnist for the Washington Post Writers Group. John Hope Franklin is a professor at Duke University. Professors Grantham and Franklin have completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center, where Professor Grantham wrote a book about 20th century Southern politics, and Professor Franklin wrote a biography of George Washington Williams, the 19th century black political leader. Here is Dewey Grantham.
Do you think, you gentlemen, think that attitudes toward the South and toward Southern politics have changed as a result of Lyndon Johnson and Jimmy Carter?
I don't think there's any question but that they've changed, some for the better and some for the worse, perhaps. Of course, Lyndon Johnson was a remarkable politician by any standards. He had the skills we've been talking about, the legislative skills. He had the know-how. He had the sense of the needs of his constituencies and so forth. And in that way, I think that he demonstrated once and for all the capacity of a Southern president to operate effectively at the national level. I don't think there's any question about that. Now, with respect to Carter, if I may just go on a moment, Carter might have undone some of that unwittingly, largely because of his lack of skills in trying to mobilize the resources of the country, particularly the Congress, to go forward with a program which he was trying to conceive. There was so little in the way of effective legislative leadership coming out of the White House at the time that it might have tempted some Americans to try to generalize about the political capacities of Southern leaders at the national level. Maybe after all, they were just sort of local yokels.
I agree with John Hope. It was a sort of double-edged reaction, I think, people had to both these people. Now, and when Lyndon Johnson, who had in fact in the Senate, as you know, been very influential in passing the first modern Civil Rights Act, I think it was in 1957 or so. Yeah. But nonetheless, there was still a perception, even when he was vice president and on the eve of his assuming the presidency, that somehow any Southerner would necessarily, any white Southerner would necessarily introduce a sort of retrograde direction in civil rights. Of course, Lyndon Johnson thoroughly allayed that and made, I think, Jimmy Carter's election possible, because we know that without the very substantial black vote that Carter got, he could not conceivably have been elected, because he wouldn't have carried the South in all probability. But there is about both Lyndon Johnson and Jimmy Carter, maybe all presidential personalities are extraordinary in some way, but you would hardly say that maybe there is no such thing as a typical Southern politician. But in a sense, in many senses, both Lyndon Johnson and Jimmy Carter departed from sort of conventional norms among Southern politicians. They were both very unusual and in many ways atypical examples of Southern politicians. But there is a kind of strange paranoia that we in the South have about the perception of our politics and culture and so forth. the whole superstition about the myth of the Northeastern media, for example, to me at least, speaking as one who has practiced journalism both in the South and in Washington, is rather funny, because in fact, if you take the New York Times, just for example, as perhaps a citadel of the Northeastern media, so-called, you have Turner Catledge, a Mississippian, as managing editor. Clifton Daniels from Zebulon, North Carolina, as a sometime executive editor. You have Tom Wicker of North Carolina as a sometime associate editor and columnist. And the influence of the South, in at least in print journalism, and to a degree in television journalism, where you have somebody like Dan Rather from Texas, and even Walter Cronkite, who was a border state man from Missouri. It's simply, to the extent that we have this paranoia about the so-called Northeastern media, it's probably not based on any fact. It's more a reflection of the perception of the politicians' perception of the press than of the press's perception of the politicians.
I wish we had time, Ed, to debate that. You'd have to, for example, you have to go beyond the New York Times, which is generous, yeah. I think, in so many ways.
Yeah.
When you get beyond that with respect to print journalism, I think that a case could be made for a certain kind of prejudice or hostility to Southern politicians on the national scene. I think there is a tendency, if no more than to make a kind of caricature of them in so many instances.
I'd like to add a footnote to what's been said about the perceptions of the South. This is to emphasize what seems to me to be the importance of the changed perceptions of the region and its institutions, including politics, by Southerners themselves. I think in a way that's very hard to measure, Southerners, after the election of Johnson, and particularly after the election of Jimmy Carter, felt emancipated, felt proud, felt encouraged to believe that they really had rejoined the Union. And it may be that white Southerners, John, somehow even felt a sense of pride that the politics of race had been diminished by Johnson and by Carter's campaigning and by other Southern leaders.
Well, I think one of the things that Jimmy Carter will eventually be remembered for by the historians, if not in the general popular eye, but the historians in the long run will determine what that will be for the future, is that he brought, after the problems of the 60s, not just the Vietnam War, and he touched a lot of chords with regard to family, local groups. He reached working people in the Midwest without the onus of race that had been attached to Wallace's touching those people. And I think that in the long run, the restoration of some of those traits which we often identify as Southern may help.
Yes, I think that may be true. I can't resist the temptation, though, to suggest that they got over a good deal of that euphoria rather rapidly, and by the time Carter was up for re-election, they had begun to turn away from him.
That's probably true, but I predict that these attitudes on the part of Southerners, black and white, are not going to go away.
Well, let me add a footnote to that point. Don't forget that the presidency at the time Carter came in had reached one of its nadir positions in American life. Congress was anxious to make a resurgence, reclaim its equality of power, and they weren't much prepared, unless you worked at it very hard, to be responsive to a president anymore. They hadn't had to do that. And this reminds me the fact that there are a number of coalitions that any president has to put together. And the number of roles that a president has to assume. Somebody has even said that you need three different people in the presidency. You need somebody who can capture the nomination, you need somebody who can win the election, and then you need somebody who can run the office. And of course, Jimmy Carter was remarkably successful in capturing the nomination, and he even did quite well winning the presidency. But he just lacked those skills that put these other aspects of the role together. And then in his attempt to make an image for himself, which is the whole new technology of communications has made so necessary, together with the ambitions of certain type of people. When he came on and gave a fireside chat in his little sweater with a rather hangdog look on his face, all you had to do was remember Franklin Roosevelt's voice or have seen Franklin Roosevelt at some time, and you knew the difference. And when he walked back to the White House, it all looked so contrived. So contrast that with Reagan's assumption of the role of the king in contrast to the role of the prime minister.
Some of you may remember a comment that Robert Penn Warren made a long time ago when he said, to paraphrase him, that the Civil War claimed the Confederate States for the Union, but paradoxically, it made the South more Southern. Now, that's an interesting comment, I think, on the part of Warren. I think that for a long time, that was true. That is, up until about mid-century, if not later, speaking of the 20th century, the South in politics did speak with one voice. But it seems to me that one of the momentous aspects of the transformation that we've been talking about today is the fact that if there is a political tradition in the South today, it's a complex of attitudes and values, and that there are many voices speaking for the political South today. It's a much more open, diversified, competitive, and I think promising political region as a result.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You've been listening to the second of two discussions about politics in the modern American South. The panelists were Dewey Grantham and William Havard of Vanderbilt University, Edwin Yoder, a syndicated columnist for the Washington Post Writers Group, and John Hope Franklin of Duke University. Professors Grantham and Franklin have completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center. Professor Franklin wrote a biography of George Washington Williams, the 19th century black political leader. Professor Grantham wrote a book about 20th century Southern politics. Next week on Soundings, a discussion about detective fiction. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join me this week for part two in the Soundings series on politics in the American South. To what extent is Southern politics a peculiar expression of American society? How has the shape of Southern politics evolved over the last half century? And with what noteworthy effects on regional and national culture? The panelists for Soundings are Dewey Grantham and William Havard of Vanderbilt University, Edwin Yoder, a syndicated columnist for the Washington Post Writers Group, and John Hope Franklin of Duke University. Politics in the American South, Part 2, this week on Soundings, from the National Humanities Center on this station.